writers, films. Some of the artists include Native American storyteller Ed Edmo, musician Michelle Fuji, poetry from Ken Yoshikawa, Lakayana Drury, and Aaron Springs, theater artist Damaris Webb, and also there's going to be a conversation with activist and dancer Jizao Hata. My organization, Meteorites, will also be presenting two performances, and they're going to be followed by conversations about COVID-19 anti-Asian American Pacific Islander racism. Now we're going to go out with music by Joe Kai, and I want to tell you about his online concert on May 9th at 7 p.m. It's hosted by Alberta Rose Theatre, and Joe Kai is such a talented violinist, looper, composer, and storyteller, and he's based in Portland, although he toured internationally, and we hope that he will be able to tour internationally again. He's going to be performing a solo concert live stream to your living room. All of this is living room art as far as I'm concerned, so I hope you can support it. Now, Joe's concert, you can find out more at albertarosetheater.com. That's it for Stage and Studio. Thank you for listening. You can hear this show again at stageandstudio.org or kbu.fm/stageandstudio, and like us on facebook.com/stage_and_studio. I'm going to try to keep doing these new shows and report on what's happening in our own community in the arts. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope that you'll tune in again next week. So till next time, I'm D. Mae Roberts.
No, I am no longer scared. But I find that I'm reaching for the glue. So stick on me and go. Lick your wounds and we'll grow together. So stick on me and go. Lick your wounds and we'll grow together.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Have him on my wall. Andy, whoa, silver stream. Can't tell them apart at all.
Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to Art Focus, and I am Amanda Clem. Today we'll be talking with Melanie Flood, a Portland triple threat in the art scene, an artist, an educator, and a gallery owner. Thank you for joining us, Melanie. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Wow, I've never been referred to as a triple threat before. That's kind of amazing.
It occurred to me this morning, since you're so broadly divided, I think, in terms of where your focuses lie in the art scene, you've really hit like the major players. So I'm super excited to talk with you about this. And I first met you as an artist. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. Like, tell me a little bit about your art focuses now, these days. Like, what are you working on presently?
Well, I have a show coming up at 1430 Contemporary, who represents me in the fall. And I haven't had a show since March 2018, which was at Ditch Projects with Evan Lalonde. So I've had a lot of time to think about the kind of work I want to make. And right now I'm not really making anything. I'm still kind of in the like setting up my studio phase, and just got a camera from a friend and a new tripod. So I'm kind of just setting things up. But right now I've been thinking a lot about women in particular that don't have children, and also women that have children, and the crazy stories of women that have faked pregnancies. So I don't know where any of this is going to lead in my work, but as you know about my work, I use a lot of props. So I've been looking at like fake pregnancy bellies and doing a lot of research on these kind of historical stories about women that have faked pregnancies for many different reasons. So that's kind of what I'm interested in right now, in addition to this binder from the 90s called Teen Works. It's kind of like a subscription, and every month you'd get like a little section. One would be like beauty or boys or physical education, and it's like really, you know, quirky and has all the 90s vibes that I like. So I've just been kind of looking and thinking about those two things, but haven't made anything just yet.
Interesting. So those seem two different tangents there, but tell me a little bit more about the subscription magazine. So are you getting them currently?
No, it's all vintage. It's all old. Oh, okay. It's something that my brother's girlfriend actually gave to me like in 1992, and I had like thrown it out long ago, but I was able to find a copy on eBay. And it's like a guide to living life as a girl. So it's very gendered, and it just gives you tips on like how to attract a boy, or, you know, what boys like to talk about, or mm-hmm. how you should dress when you meet a boy. It also goes into what colors are good for you based on your skin tone or your eye color. And it's very much marketed towards white people. So it's very narrow in its focus. So I'm also interested in that.
That's cool. So is the photography in those publications, is that part of what is drawing you to them? Because I know a lot of those are very like, they are geared, and they're very, especially the 90s look is very specific. So.
Oh, definitely. There's just like really harsh lighting and really intense makeup, but also a little bit of it is kind of like, it's like sexualized too at the same time, which is like weird because it's like really marketed towards like young girls. But I guess it's marketed towards young girls that are kind of figuring out their sexuality. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Yeah, it's definitely about the photographs for sure, like these portraits of women, or like a girl in a tree when she's like on a date with a boy, or, you know, it's just this stuff that's very cliche, but is very particular style to the 1990s, which is when I came of age. So I'm really attracted to all of that stuff.
Yeah, definitely. But it definitely sounds familiar to me too, in a way, like what perfume smells should you wear? Maybe food scented.
Yeah,
in particular, I remember cotton candy perfume. Ooh. Thinking like that is so oddly specifically targeted towards young women.
Totally. I remember filling out one of those forms, and it was like, you should smell like vanilla because boys like sweet things.
Yeah, just like, ooh, yeah, kind of creepy in a way.
Yeah, no, it's totally creepy. But there's other stuff of like, you know, how to get some privacy from your parents and how to like be a little bit more independent, but it's still couched in this language that feels very sexist and almost misogynistic in many ways, but it's meant to be helpful. But of course we know times change. But
and so then can we go back then and talk about the other part that you're focusing on, which are the bodily additions, pregnant belly.
I watch a lot of Lifetime. I don't know. Everyone knows what Lifetime is, but Lifetime Movie Network. It's like something that my mom and I like have bonded over the years.
Yeah.
And there's just so many films with this as a topic, as women fake a pregnancy. You know, it's like they fake a pregnancy to like keep a boyfriend that has left them, or they fake a pregnancy because their best friend is pregnant and they want, you know, to be pregnant with them. Or there's like the women that can't have children but want to, so they fake a pregnancy and then they kidnap someone else's baby. So it's just like a crazy, I don't even know why. I mean, I don't have children, so I'm sure part of it is I don't have children, so I'm like interested in these like strange like phenomenon of people wanting to have them. So I don't really know. Sometimes I get into weird stuff and I'm like, I don't know what this says about me as an artist or a person, but I have to just pull a thread and see what happens, you know?
Yeah, dive in.
Yeah, so, you know, I spend a lot of time on the internet looking at weird props. Like, I made a whole body of work that was about, like, chest wrinkle preventers. One was called a titty bear, and it's like a little bear that you put in between your breasts. So they don't, when you lean over to like sleep, that it doesn't make a chest like wrinkle. So these like highly specific things that women are supposed to be worrying about, you know, there's like markets for all of those things. But then there's things like fake baby belly, so when you are pregnant, you can go to the store and try on pants and like know how they're going to fit in like 6 months or whatever. But then they're also used for these like other like strange like uses. I remember reading something maybe like in the fall about a woman that faked her pregnancy and then killed her friend and tried to steal the baby. Yeah, so it's like really like far out stuff.
Very outrageous.
Yeah, it's totally outrageous, but I just think like there's so much pressure on women to be mothers or to like not be mothers so you can have a good career. Like you just can't win either way. And I'm just interested in that, you know, how we just can't seem to be doing the right thing no matter what choices we make in life. We're always judged.
We're always judged and we're always kind of compelled to see if we can figure out what it's like to see us ourselves from an outside perspective. Like what would it be like to walk around with a big pregnant belly and how differently would people treat you?
Yeah, definitely. I think it would make a huge difference, you know. I think it makes people look at you a totally different way.
Definitely. So that's super interesting to think about because when the kind of like inspiration is like an outrageous story, like the one you just told me, or like a Lifetime, it seems like a real Lifetime movie, honestly. And there are like quote unquote like practical uses for these pregnant bellies, which is trying on pants. I never considered that before. So it's like using these props kind of like for like a positive good reason, and then for like a kind of like interesting psychologically reason. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, we'll see. I mean, I just like we'll collect things and then they'll just lay around the studio for a while and then it will just kind of click like what I want to do with the thing.
Yeah.
And then sometimes I just collect things and I don't do anything with them. And then I have to try to sell them, you know, or return them or bring them to Goodwill or something, you know.
You are definitely, I know your work does deal a lot with props and you make sculpture out of them and then those are photographed. And so I guess I'm wondering, do you consider the work that you make sculptural in a very specific way? Or are you always looking at those objects as a photograph?
I mean, I'm definitely doing like sculptural gestures, but the end product is always a photograph because, you know, it's just like, how can I arrange things to present them for the camera?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so concerned with presentation, just the idea of like how things are supposed to look. And how often in advertising, you know, things are retouched or, you know, messed with to a point of unrecognition, like things don't even look how they look in real life. And I love that about using cheap props. It's like with really beautiful lighting and the right angle, like you can make something like a fake boob that's like a stress ball, like look like a beautiful object. And I just love that about photography, how it can manipulate an everyday object into something really exquisite. And I guess like with sculpture, you know, I mean, not to say that all sculpture like lasts forever, but in my mind, when I think of sculpture, I think of something that you're going to like see from all angles and that like it lasts. Like I usually just take everything apart after the photo's done. So it's more of like an arrangement more mm-hmm. than something that's like a sculpture per se.
During this quarantine, during the pandemic, have you been experimenting with any other modes of making art?
I started taking pictures in 1989. Mm-hmm. So I've been looking at existing work of mine and trying to kind of contextualize it within like my current art practice, which is new for me because I've taken lots of snapshots of different things for years, but I've never really considered it like my work necessarily. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's like a long thread through the last 30 years of photos that I've been taking. So I guess like that has been a little bit of a new mode of working for me, just like looking at past work and seeing if it can be relevant today. In particular, like could it be relevant in my show in the fall with the work that I'm more known for, which is like the sculptural arrangement, still life stuff. So, I'm in this like thinking stage. It's like thinking and gathering and like organizing, which I think for a lot of artists is like a really big part of the making of the thing.
That's totally funny. One of my favorite things I've ever heard about photography as an art form is that you spend like 10% of your time taking the photographs and 90% of the time editing, like sequencing and trying to find the through lines for them. And
it
always made me laugh. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely true. Like I feel like once I get the ball rolling and I have like everything set up, like yesterday I set up my seamless and my lights and I'm like, okay, so that's set up. Now I just need to like get the camera out and then I'll just take a lot of pictures. And since I shifted from film to digital when I was in grad school, like I make work so much faster, but it takes a while to get to the point that I'm like, okay, pictures will be taken today.
Yeah.
But once I'm there, I can complete things pretty quickly. But then it's a matter of like, oh, well, what photo worked and doing the editing and then sequencing and then making prints and seeing like, oh, does this even deserve to like be printed on the more expensive paper, you know, all of those types of questions. But yeah, it's such a long process, just everything other than the photo taking.
Yeah. It's the secret life of an artist that nobody really talks about, all the prep work that goes into each individual image that's made.
Yeah, it takes forever.
Takes forever. So I'm curious about, I know you've recently worked a job with Paige Powell, working on her archive.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, did that kind of help you when you went through all of your photographs? Did that background work help you kind of see that in your own work, see that
it
had the potential? Yeah,
definitely. I think, you know, there's so many parts of my work with Paige that have been inspiring to me, and also, you know, kind of heart-wrenching in many ways, because I think like Paige, she's known, you know, for being an animal rights activist, and she's known for doing some curatorial projects, but I think a lot of people know her for her photographs of New York in the 80s and the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And she's made so many contributions to so many other people's archives just because she did so much photography and videography, even. It's amazing. But then, you know, looking through all of these photos, you know, you see all these people and you're like, oh, look at this photo of Andy Warhol. And then you're like, oh, he's like 30 something here or 40 something here. And then you're like, oh, but he's not alive anymore. You know, it's like you become so familiar with the way people look during a certain time. And then maybe like I'd met some people in real life, and then I'm like, wow, like I know you from these photos when you were a kid, and now you're like in your 60s or 70s. So it does this thing to time where it compresses it.
Mm-hmm.
That really affected me in a major way. I was like, wow, time goes really fast, and it's important to like acknowledge where we are in the moment, and to also do a better job of recording things. Like, I feel like when I was younger, I journaled a lot and I took tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of pictures. And then over the last decade or so, I've taken a lot less photos of my life and have made more art, which is fine. But I feel like definitely working with Paige, I was like, oh, I need to start taking pictures of my daily life more frequently, even if they're just like cruddy snapshots. And also I need to take more pictures with film and not rely on my iPhone so much, because there's just a nice quality to film that I forgot about because of working with her. I was just like in the film all day. But yeah, working with Paige was amazing. Just seeing someone's like life become this, you know, this giant monograph, and that it just touched so many different parts of New York, like fashion and music and hip hop. And then obviously art, she just has her hands in everything.
How did you hook up with her? How did you get to be working with her?
Through Rose Dixon, who is an artist that I work with. And when Paige started to be in conversation with Gucci and Dashwood Books about publishing this like huge thing of her photographs, Rose was like, oh, we need more people to work here. Because it was only Rose. Like, Rose is the only person that worked at the archive for a while.
Yeah.
So Rose brought me on, and then we just like brought a whole bunch of other people on. But I was super excited because when I was in undergrad, I was obsessed with Andy Warhol. I mean, I had been obsessed with Warhol my whole life, and I had read like every single book about him. And my favorite was Andy's diaries, which Paige like was frequently mentioned. And when I was moving to Portland, my friend and, you know, my prior mentor, Devin DeCue of Zing Magazine, she was like, oh, you have to somehow hook up with Paige Powell. And I was like, oh my God, like, how am I going to be like meeting Paige Powell? Like, she's like a celebrity, you know, in my mind.
Yeah.
And then Rose was like, do you want to come work at the Paige Powell archive? And I was like, are you kidding? Yeah. I'm like, that sounds amazing. And then I met Paige, and I was just so smitten by her and just so impressed with just her whole everything. She's been like a lifelong vegan. She doesn't wear any animal products. She still takes pictures like all day, every day to this day. She's such a generous, amazing human. So I felt really lucky to get to work on that project. And I'm sad that project's over, but I'm still in touch with Paige. So that's nice.
That is nice. That sounds really inspiring and cool to be a part of.
Oh yeah. We went to New York and to Los Angeles and to London and to Tokyo to work on this subject. So it was pretty amazing.
That's crazy. I love it.
Yeah.
It was cool. That is really cool. I have so many other questions, but we should focus our time a little bit. Let's say they do flow really seamlessly together, though. Let's talk about your experience as a gallerist, as a gallery owner. So I know we'll just start by telling the audience that you started your first gallery from your apartment in New York City in 2008. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. So first, the decision to open a gallery in your home. What was that kind of motivator?
Well, it's funny because right now we are in the midst of COVID, and then we were like in the beginning of the 2008 recession. It just felt like the whole world was imploding and everything felt really unfamiliar and unstable. And I remember that time period so clearly, just like the way my body and my brain felt. As an artist, I had been working for many years at different newspapers and magazines, and I knew a lot of photographers at that time that weren't exhibiting anywhere. There just was no young galleries. And then especially in 2008, like galleries started closing, so there was even less places, and there was a really great scene online. So I knew all of these people, but none of them were in real life. So I went to this, Humble Arts finally had a brick and mortar show in Brooklyn, and I went, and it was like all of the people from the internet, it seemed like we're in this one warehouse, and we had all just like finally met, like just after knowing each other from online, but we couldn't really talk to anyone because it was just like a giant party and it was really loud and you couldn't see the work. And I remember feeling like, oh, I'm so excited that this community is here, but it's so massive and like you can't talk to anybody. So I was like, what if I just did this in my apartment? Because a few years earlier, I'd gone to Chicago to Art Chicago in the Oak Park section. I went to a few home galleries, and I'll never forget, there was this woman who had Amy Silliman watercolors on her refrigerator, and it was like her gallery. I just had no idea that you could break the rules like that, you know? Yeah. Like, I just feel like my arts education like didn't teach me anything like that. So I just opened up my kitchen and we just started having shows. And it lasted for a year before, or maybe 2 years before we moved out to Portland. It was just nice to have a smaller space, more intimate, so you can actually like talk to people and see the work. And it was really a great project.
That sounds like very fun to have, especially with new friends and new community, and a good way to build that. So then you moved to Portland, and then a few years later started MFP here in Portland. And so that space, when everyone is allowed to go back outside and to these places, it's downtown above Kelly's Olympian Bar, but you've been able to host many solo shows and several group shows, and it's been one of my favorite galleries to visit, I have to say. Always really, really, really interesting work, and you're one to host artist talks and other programs, crossover with other artists and poets to host readings in your space, and you really used your space, I think, in a wonderful way, and part of the community that kind of you're able to bring all of these people, your students, the other artists in town, other gallery people, other people who are interested, or just, you know, walking in off the street. I'd have to imagine being downtown, you must have had at least a few strangers come in.
Yeah, there's been some perplexed visitors off the street, for sure.
Yeah. So that's been really wonderful to see. And I know you just made an announcement, too, that you're now representing some of artists that you've shown in the past.
I am.
So, yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. Like, what does it mean to represent an artist these days?
Yeah, these days. I think there's, these days, and also what does it mean to represent artists as an artist myself, running an artist-run space?
Right. You know, and then, and then tangentially to that, too, being represented yourself by 1430 Gallery.
It's a lot.
1430 is also one of the great galleries in town. And so, yeah, Janine's been running this for, over a decade, a long time.
So
there's a huge network here, and you're all working very closely together. So as an artist running an artist-run space, and now representing these artists, and then also being represented yourself by Janine at 1430. How does that all work together?
Well, I guess I decided to represent artists because I feel like I'm already so committed to these five women's practices. Like I've already been helping them with like grant applications and finding them other opportunities like outside of MFP and bringing them to art fairs and like finding people to write about their work. Like I'm already doing the work that a gallery owner is supposed to do for someone that's being represented. Mm-hmm. So I felt like, why not just make it more formal and just make an announcement? Because I feel like also it makes other people take artists more seriously when they have representation, that they have someone that's like publicly believes in them, is willing to put resources and time into promoting and being a champion of their work. And it just felt like the next thing to do, especially now. I just feel like there's so much uncertainty, and I know like everyone I've been talking to is really worried, like our space is going to stay open, how are they going to exist, and there's just so much anxiety surrounding all of that, that it just really felt like a positive thing to share. So that really is, you know, why I did it, because I'm already doing all of those things, so why not just let everyone know that this is all happening, you know?
Yeah, make it official.
Yeah, make it official. And also I think it helps the artists too. Like, you know, I sent them all an email a couple of days ago, and I was, you know, I just introduced them all, because they all know who each other's are, but they might not know each other intimately, because some of them don't live in Portland, and just said like, let's just make this a space of mutual support. And, you know, let's talk about all of our goals, like whether it's like you want a new artist statement or you want to try to have a show at MoMA or something, you know, like let's just like put all of our dreams and aspirations out there and just see like what we can make possible. Because I really think that like if you work really hard and you just are crazy, you know, you can make a lot of great things happen for yourself. And especially if you're part of a little artist group, and you know, if everyone's thinking about each other's practices, that sometimes opportunities come up for one artist that might not be the right fit, but if they know someone else, they'll make that connection. Mm-hmm. So I feel like, you know, that's another thing that's nice about representing a small group of artists, is just they can rely on each other for information and opportunities also. Yeah, as an artist, I think it's nice for me to represent artists, because I'm like, oh, I know what I need to ask for from my gallery, from 1430. And I think that, because I just have my artists asking me for stuff all the time. So I'm like, oh, like these are normal things to ask for, you know, so then I feel like comfortable asking for stuff, you know, because I think initially I didn't really know like what I was allowed to ask for, what I wanted help with. And every time I asked anything from Jeannie, she's like, yeah, of course, this is what I'm here for. And I'm like, oh, okay, I just feel strange like asking you for stuff, because it's like, it's work, you know?
Right.
But that's the whole essence of it. It's like, you know, if a gallery is going to take a percentage of your sales, you know, there's things that they need to do to make it worth it. And I think it's great to have an advocate and just have another set of eyes to look at your work and to help during that editing process, when you just have like a pile of images and maybe half of them are garbage. You know, Jeannie will come in and be like, I think this is working, I don't think this is working, go in this direction. Like, she's so fast with it. So that's been really helpful for me. And then also just professionally, you know, I've learned a lot from her about how to run a gallery, and how to organize shows, and just seeing how she handles stuff helps me. So I feel like it's all like been mutually beneficial, you know, to have representation myself for certain.
Definitely. It all sounds like a very, like, it's like a catalyst for all of these other things happening.
Yeah, it is, definitely. You know, everything feeds into everything else. And I mean, I definitely have to compartmentalize sometimes, because, you know, I need time for my own work, and I need space to think about my own practice. And sometimes that can be difficult when I'm like fielding emails from the people that I work with. Right. But also, there's a lot of time in the day. And I think during this pandemic, I've seen how much time goes to waste in my life. And I'm sure everyone else is feeling that way, that, you know, I have a lot more time on my hands than I realize, especially since I'm not really working right now. So
yeah.
Teaching this one class.
Teaching. So yeah, actually, let's talk about that. You're teaching. You teach at Portland State University. You teach photography and darkroom.
Yeah, and I teach digital photo and darkroom. And right now I'm teaching an upper division class, which is exciting because I basically just got to decide what the class was. It's a special topics in photo. So the class is based on The Photographer's Playbook, which is a book by Gregory Halpern and Jason Fulford that was published by Aperture a few years back. And it's just this amazing compendium of assignments and kind of prompts written by like all of the photographers that you can possibly imagine. Anyone that you've ever liked is in this book. So every week we're just going through the book and picking an assignment, and then they're working on it. And then I've also had some artists come and talk to the class via Zoom, which has been really nice and informative. And I feel like I like Zoom teaching more than I like teaching in real life. I don't know, there's something about it. Like, I just feel like we're getting so much done. I think also because there's not the technical bit of like figuring out the dark room or like helping someone with Photoshop. Like, we just get to talk about the work. Since it's like a 300 level class, everyone already knows that stuff. So, and I'm just letting students use whatever camera they have access to, because a lot of them had to leave Portland. So it's just been a fun class to just work through ideas.
I have one last question before we wrap it up. What would you like to take with you, I think, once we're able to get back to our less quarantined life?
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of recognizing that I have all these incredible people in my life and that I have time to spend talking to them more often through like letters, through actual phone calls, and not just like half-assed text messages or like sending each other weird memes through DM. Like, it's meaningful to have, you know, actual conversations with people. And I think that a lot of us have forgotten what it's like to have that with social media. Like, we feel like we're connecting with people, but we're actually not.
Well, thank you so much for being on Art Focus with me today, Melanie. I really appreciate your time.
This was so much fun. I'm so glad to be on Art Focus.
Melanie, what is the best place for people to go online to find
out? You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Also heard at Translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and Translator K282B.